Okay, the next appeal we're going to hear argument on is appeal number 21-2370, Grace Instrument Industries versus Chandler Instruments Company and Amatec Incorporated. Mr. Laney, you're arguing today for Grace Instrument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And you've reserved 5 minutes of time, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
My apologies for the delay, Your Honor.
Not at all. Please go ahead.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you for having us here. It's so nice to be back in person again. We're here to flip two claim constructions from the district court. One is the enlarged chamber term, and one is the driving means term. I've got three major points I'd like to leave with y'all today for each term, if I do nothing else. So I'll start with the enlarged chamber term. The good news is your eyes get a break from that tiny writing the PTO puts in the patents that we all have to struggle and read. You actually don't even have to look at the 877 patent. You can look straight at the district court's opinion. You can look on page 10, second paragraph. The district court assumed that a person of ordinary and skill in the art, the 877 patent tells them the enlarged chamber must be large enough to fill that compression void to make sure there's no mixing in that bottom chamber. By saying large enough, of course, that's a baseline. It must be that large, but also could be bigger. And if you look at all this court's guidance, Nautilus 2, Mentor Graphics, Sonics Tech, they all say if you give that type of parameter in the specification, you give an example a PCETA would understand it can go by, that's enough of a baseline.
Has the district court defined the level of skill in the art in this case as of yet?
We have an expert declaration that defines it, but that was not adopted into the court's holding. So right there, Your Honor, you don't even have to look at the patent. That is one way the district court's holding must be overturned. So that's point one. Point two, the district court said, well, it doesn't say why the enlarged chamber is different than the prior art. Because it doesn't say that, it must be an indefinite term of degree. Now, there are cases, the Hong Dong case we cite in our brief, that say that is one way to define a term of degree, how it's different than the prior art. It's not the exclusive way. It's not the only way, but it's one way you can do it. And the district court was just flat wrong on that. Our patent says in seven different places what the problem with the prior art was and how we fix it. And if you look in the first column, you look in the descriptions of all the preferred embodiments, it says the problem with the prior art chambers is they weren't big enough. They didn't hold enough fluid. So these machines get into these enormous pressures, 30,000 PSI.
Would you say that your specification defines the claim term enlarged chamber?
It defines it in the context of what it must be able to do.
Right.
Because and how big it needs to be.
The term enlarged chamber shows up in only a single sentence, pretty much at the tail end of the written description.
Well,
tail end sentence doesn't say enlarged chamber, and here's what we mean by enlarged chamber.
Yes, Your Honor. So the enlarged chamber, if we look at the claims and we say, what is the enlarged chamber? The claims specifically define it as the area between the top section, between the bottom section. That's where it is. So we can now go look at the preferred embodiment and the other three example embodiments. Where is that area? It's that combination of 45 plus 49. So by knowing in the claims where it is, we can now look at the preferred embodiments and see that. And when they describe
how do we know that the preferred embodiments aren't just preferred embodiments as opposed to being an actual definition of what it means to be in a large chamber?
Because we had an expert go through in very great detail that a PCETA would see large enough, see this intermediate area. He would understand that is the enlarged portion that needs to be enlarged, that needs to be big enough. Of course, large enough and enlarged are synonyms. They mean the same thing. And our expert went through in great detail with the patent. He said, hey, this is...
This gets into a very tricky question, which is, to what part of this exercise is a question of law versus a question of fact. I know that when it comes to reading intrinsic evidence, usually in our case law, we say that's a question of law. It's up to us as a court to read this fully integrated legal instrument and try to discern what the meaning of it is. You're telling us that you had an expert comment on the meaning of the specification, and there are times where that is appropriate. I'm just trying to figure out if this particular instance is one of those instances.
Well, the district court completely ignored our expert.
I understand that.
The
question I'm putting to you is, when is it appropriate for an expert to be testifying as to the meaning of the patent, as opposed to that question really being a de novo legal exercise?
Yes, Your Honor. If we look at the Phillips versus AWH case, which is sort of what I look at as the primary claim construction, and I know everybody in here is familiar with it, but it starts off and says the intrinsic record's best. We want to look at it first. But it also says, when trying to find out the meaning of terms in a patent, extrinsic evidence can be helpful and can be used. And I believe it gives examples of dictionary definitions and experts. And that's especially true in this case, where our expert, and you'll notice in the brief, they say, well, he didn't align with the patent, but they don't give any examples. He literally goes line by line in the patent. This is where my enlarged chamber feature is. This is how it's discussed. This is what it's supposed to do. He gives two examples. He goes through two tests. He says, this is why the prior art doesn't have one. It allows that oil to seep into the bottom chamber. And then he also says, here is a current design that does have one. The chamber's big enough to prevent that seepage.
I have just an ancillary question that's not directly related to what you're arguing, but I just want to understand the claim. Claim one talks about a top section of the pressure vessel, quote, filled with a pressurization fluid. And then it also talks about a bottom section, which I believe is, or a lower section that's filled with a test sample. Is it your understanding of this claim that it's not just directed to the device itself, but it's the device with the fluids contained inside the device?
A device, it's a apparatus claim, Your Honor.
It is an apparatus claim, but it could also be a claim that's not just the container itself, but the container with these fluids inside the container in the locations that are designated in the claim.
Yes, Your Honor. It has to be a machine capable of having those fluids inside these different chambers.
Okay, so when it says top section filled with fluid, it's not actually calling for a claim that's a combination of the structure with the fluid inside that section of the device.
No, Your Honor. I believe it's calling for a...
That's the way it reads, to let you know.
Yes, Your Honor. So if you look at the first column, it talks about how they used the old prior art. They used to have this rubber seal.
I understand everything about the prior art. I just want to get your understanding of this claim. On the record, but anyway.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Let me answer your question. I shouldn't have. I went too far off on a tangent. Let me get more direct for you. This is what's called an open top viscometer. And I don't know if you can tell from the drawings, but the whole top screws off and pops off and then pops back on. And so for an open top viscometer, there is no seal in between. You just have those liquids in the top and liquids in the bottom.
You first pour in the test sample. And it fills up the bottom section, and then it also fills up this intermediate chamber, what you've referred to as the enlarged chamber.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then you put the pressurization fluid in.
Then you screw
the pressurization fluid with the closed cap starts applying a lot of pressure on the sample fluid underneath, compressing it down to a point where it's not the test sample fluid is not completely filling the enlarged chamber anymore. It's going the level's going down inside there. But for what you want is to ensure that the level of the sample fluid doesn't go below and the enlarged chamber and down into the bottom section.
That is exactly right, Your Honor. This patent is all about eliminating what it calls mixing. And I used the blender example in my reply, that bottom chamber, the prior art way of doing things, they just said, hey, these fluids have different densities. So if you think of a blender as the bottom chamber, the blender can be full almost always with drilling fluid, and then it can have oil on the top, which is what they used to pressurize. Great. When that's sitting on your kitchen counter, those liquids will stay separated. Whippy, right? That's how they did it the old way. The problem is these machines have these big rotors that... So if you think about when you turn on your blender, now all of a sudden that oil's not just floating at the top. It's everywhere in a million pieces. So the idea behind this invention is the prior art did that old way. They relied on the different densities of the fluids to separate, and ours is saying no. Excuse me, Your Honor, I'm getting to my rebuttal time, but ours is saying no, you have to completely eliminate any oil from going there. The enlarged chamber must be big enough to eliminate any oil from going in there. And although the enlarged chamber is only used in that one section, Your Honor, I think there's so much. First off.
Right. It says large enough, sufficiently large, and multiple times through the specification.
Can I just, before we get to your friend, make sure I understand your answer to Judge Chen's question. Are you contending that an empty one of these machines could infringe before it's filled with fluid?
You would need to fill it with fluid to test and see if it's capable of performing.
So let's say I've done that testing and then I drain it and empty it completely and it's just sitting there. So I know from my prior test it's capable, but now it's empty. It's not filled with fluid and the claim requires filled with fluid. Am I infringing at that moment just based on the capability?
Yes, Your Honor.
Even despite how your claims are written. Did your expert address that question?
Well, and I'm into my rebuttal time, so I'll keep going if that's okay with y'all.
Yeah.
Your Honor, they raised the argument that this couldn't be an apparatus claim because of the way it's written. They said because of containing fluids and stuff like that, it has to be the hybrid method apparatus, which makes it invalid. And the district court flatly rejected that. And they never appealed it. So respectfully, I don't think that issue is up on appeal. If it is, I would love an opportunity
And we know you're in your rebuttal, but I just want you, and we'll give you a little more time on rebuttal, to just comment about the means for driving the rotor to rotate. And just get on the record so that, you know, you're allowed to say it in rebuttal, something about why the located in the bottom section, why doesn't it modify the means for driving as opposed to the rotor?
Well, let me broaden that. Can I say two quick points, Your Honor?
And it's very quick.
Yes, Your Honor. The reason is the claim term requires it to be in the bottom section. The bottom section is the inside bottom of the pressure vessel.
I understand the debate about pressure vessel versus viscometer, but what about just grammar-wise, why isn't it modifying the means for driving?
And that's because of patent law, which I think we all know is not your standard grammar, everyday grammar. It has rules, all these special rules. And one of those rules is if you use the word said, it invokes a reference to something ahead of it, a term of antecedent, I'm sure I butchered that word, antecedent basis. So when it invokes that word said, it now is saying said rotor to rotate located in the bottom section. So that said is now referring to something above it, and the component immediately above it is the rotor. And I wanted to say one more thing, if I may, Your Honor, about the driving means. And that is, we have Claim 14 is so important. Claim 14 says just a magnetic coupling can be a driving means. And the district court held claim one can never have just the magnetic coupling. The magnetic coupling has to be the magnetic coupling plus holder, motor, gearbox. So now we have claim one that is narrower than claim 14, which is a patent law impossibility. So I think if we look at claim 14, we see the magnetic coupling. We know from the patent, the magnetic coupling is just the driving magnet, just the pairing magnet, the force between them. If that alone can be a driving means, then each individual component, that relay or transmits driving force, should be able to be one of the driving means, and that would include that magnet holder, Your Honor, that's in the bottom section. And the one example I would give you, and I'm going to get out of here, is if you ask somebody that drives a car, you know, what do you use to drive a car? No one's going to say, I use the tires, the axles, the motor, da-da-da. Everyone's going to say, the steering wheel. right? The steering wheel, the part that relays or transmits force. And so that's what I think the patent owner was trying to say when he said just the magnetic coupling can be a driving means. He was saying any one of those individual components in the chain could be a means for driving. That would include that magnet holder, which has the great benefit of being in the bottom section. So everybody's happy in patent land. No preferred embodiments excluded. And all the claim
arguments. Let's hear from the other side.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Please begin.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. First, I'd like to address a couple of the questions that involved IPXL. And we did raise that argument below, and the district court did not adopt that those arguments. Instead, it found the claims indefinite.
Are we talking about the filled with fluid?
Yes,
question?
Exactly. So that was an argument that was before the district court. It wasn't briefed here, but it is an alternative grounds of affirmance. So we disagree. We do think that the claims do require that the pressure vessel be filled with a pressurization fluid. So it's a combination of a system and a method claim.
But why wouldn't it just be a system claim nevertheless? Like if I claim a glass with orange juice inside of it, that would be okay, right?
And that is what the district court found. But since Your Honor had questions about it, I just wanted to float it out there. It wasn't something that wasn't addressed below. There is a record on it. Oh. But I'm happy to focus on what was addressed below and, you know, the main reason.
Let's talk about enlarged chamber.
Yes. So,
and let's talk about whether the judge below, perhaps thanks to excellent advocacy, was overly narrow in looking at this claim and in assuming that enlarged chamber necessarily meant that this is a type of chamber that has to be larger than some measuring stick comparator chamber. And then because there is no such chamber defined in the specification in that way, that this is an indefinite term. And so perhaps the other way of understanding enlarged chamber is that this patent owner was his own lexicographer. He invented this term, maybe not the best choice of words, but nevertheless, when you read the entire patent, you can understand and discern what is meant and intended by enlarged chamber, and that is, you know, the kind of chamber that has the capacity to hold lots of sample fluids such that when it's under compression by the pressure fluid, the level of the fluid will go down, but it won't go down so far into the testing area because that would result in pressure fluid mixing down in the testing area.
So I have 3 points to respond to that, Your Honor. The first is a quick one, and it's that the definition of big enough to hold enough fluid to fill the compression void at maximum rated pressure is completely reading the word enlarged out of the claim. And I understand Your Honor saying, well, maybe he should have chosen a different word and he's defined that. But just from a claim construction standpoint, that seems kind of bizarre to move the word enlarged, which has an ordinary meaning that we all know is bigger than something, and now to insert it with this new concept that is very different than the plain and ordinary meaning of enlarged without a definition in the spec. So the second point is, well, then let's go. Let's look at the spec. So the enlarged chamber, as you noted, is only appears once, and all that the specification tells us in column 11 is that the enlarged chamber is 45 or 49, and you can see those on figure 1, or a combination. It doesn't tell us how large those must be. So let's take a look at figure 41, which is on appendix page, figure 1 on appendix page 41. We know enlarged chamber 45 is an enlarged chamber. It looks very small compared to the other chamber. So what makes that chamber enlarged as well as chamber 49? We can look at other places in the specification, and let's look at column 5, line 63 going into column 6. Now, this is an important part of the specification because it's something that on page 9 of its opening brief, Grace said, this is definitional. This is where we know about the enlarged chamber. But that mentions two enlarged chambers, 45 and 49 working together. We know from the figure, one is significantly smaller than the other. And we're told in column 6 that at maximum rated pressure, chamber 49 is still at least half filled with the sample liquid. So if this is the definition from the specification, why wouldn't you read that and say, okay, I get it, an enlarged chamber needs to be at least half filled with the sample liquid after compression? That's not the construction they're asking for. They've pointed to other places in the spec, but every single time that the spec mentions maximum rated pressure, it mentions chamber 49, the enlarged chamber, is still at least half filled. So Grace is picking and choosing. It's cherry picking from embodiments to come up with a construction that seems to suit it, but it's not even looking at the specification. There's no baseline.
At the same time, there's other passages in the specification, including, you know, the title itself. It's trying, the whole point of this invention is to avoid or to prevent sample contamination so that when you're measuring the viscosity of the sample, you don't have it mixed in with pressure fluid. And so that's the purpose of having this transition chamber, so that any interaction between the two fluids is occurring in the transition chamber during the testing, and not down into the testing chamber. And so if contextually we can read all these different passages and come away with that message being communicated by the patent, then why wouldn't that be sufficient to say, yeah, this is construable?
So the problem is, even with that construction, so even taking that argument as true, and as I mentioned before, I think that at least half-filled language should be given consideration. In this case, we can't define the term based on the problem that it's alleged to be solving. We know from Geneva Pharmaceuticals, which is a case that was decided by this court, that a given embodiment that would simultaneously infringe and not infringe the claims, depending on the particular testing sample used for analysis, is the epitome of an indefiniteness.
So where's the evidence that that's what we have in front of us?
Yes. So first of all, the only evidence that they point to is Mr. Bai's testimony, which actually supports us there. So if you go to appendix page 434 and 437, his testimony is that these samples will compress more or less 12%. More or less. That is not definite. That means that some could...
How? But you say it's not definite. How do I know that a person of ordinary skill in the art would say that's not definite?
Well, there's issues with Mr. Bai's testimony. You can look at appendix page 782, because in that, during his deposition, he actually disclaimed that testimony of 12%. So there's no evidence that a person of ordinary skill in the art would look at this and say, well, I know all testing fluids would compress the same amount.
Right, but it's your burden, right? You're trying to invalidate a patent claim.
Yes, absolutely. But if there's more evidence as well. So if you continue, the record is full of all the different types of testing fluids that are used. It mentions cement, hematite, barite, calcium.
Sure, but again, what can you point to that says, first of all, I don't even think we know who the person wearing a skill in the art is. The district court didn't make any finding on that. Isn't that right?
I don't have a site for that, so I believe you're correct.
Okay. So we don't know whose perspective we're supposed to look at this for to determine if the claim scope is reasonably certain, but let's put that aside for the moment. Where is the evidence that whoever the person of ordinary skill in the art looking at this patent would not be reasonably certain as to what an enlarged chamber is?
So once again, the evidence comes from the testing fluid. So I was mentioning all the different types. I can just throw out the appendix pages for you to look at later, but 4495, 224, 349, 1064, and 1078 reference tons of different types of testing materials. But let's go to Mr. Bai's testimony. And if you look on appendix page 80, he was directly asked about, is there an example where physical properties of a testing sample will not affect compressibility? And he couldn't answer that question. So there is evidence that if he's an alleged expert, he's actually the named inventor, so we question that.
That's clear and convincing evidence that the undefined person of ordinary skill in the art would know that different testing samples lead to different conclusions about infringement. Is that what you're saying?
That is part of it. There's also, if you look at where the 12% number came from, it was pulled from Chandler's brochure, and Mr. Bai actually misread the brochure. The brochure does not say that a testing sample compresses 12%. It says that there's 12% of extra space in the chamber, and of course, mathematically, whether something compresses at the bottom versus how much extra space there is in the top, those are two very different things.
Before we get any deeper into these facts, it's quite clear that the district court didn't address this particular angle for why the claims are nevertheless indefinite. And this also sounds very facty, and so perhaps, and that's a technical term, so it feels like this is an issue that would need to be resolved and addressed in the first instance by the district court, not by us on appeal. Would you agree with that?
I would not. And the reason is because indefiniteness, of course, is a question of law. And you can look
You can have underlying fact findings. And we've had cases where we've had to figure out indefiniteness and it turned on a fact question.
Well, Well, here you can look at the specification again, and I think you hit it right in the beginning with your questions about enlarged chamber. It has to mean something. It's in the claims. It has to mean something. And all that we're told is we're pointed to two boxes, two chambers. We're told each of them can be enlarged, and neither of them is enlarged. There's also a waiver issue here, which is that they told the district court that on that issue of if you go to appendix page 1446, they said if one drilling fluid compresses 10%, then the enlarged chamber must be able to fill that 10%. If
do you contend that enlarged has to be a matter of degree, or do you think it could be maybe even defined by looking at these various portions of specification we've been talking about today?
I don't think it can be defined by this specification. So in here, it needs to be a term of degree because there's no indication in the specification. Could enlarged not be a term of degree in another patent with another specification? I couldn't comment on that. But in this specification, enlarged needs to be a term of degree because we need to know what that word means. And the construction that they're proposing just leads to a whole bunch of problems. It's inconsistent than what they've previously said, and a skilled artisan is left without knowing whether the enlarged chamber actually infringes, even if they fill it with testing fluid, as he proposed.
Was there no dispute about the Fosita? Is that the reason we don't have a further definition? Like, I guess there was one proposed in the expert report or declaration. Was it just kind of agreed among the parties?
That's my understanding, is it at least didn't come up. I think that there weren't expert reports yet. But there was a request for claim construction, and the district court then made its findings. But a skilled artisan would, I think, obviously have some experience in this area, but there's still not record evidence to show that he would understand what this term means.
We've already been through this, but there's not record evidence to show that the person skilled in the art wouldn't know either, right? We just have a record that's, if it has anything, it has their expert, but it doesn't have anything from you.
But their expert alone, expert testimony is not required, as I'm sure you know from your case law, but their expert did provide the testimony that we need. And like I said, you can look at it at appendix page 782 and 800, where he does provide that support for why he wouldn't know. He says he wouldn't know. He couldn't tell you if a testing sample would compress at that rate. I'll also just quickly say that he's, of course, not an expert. He is the named inventor, and the court has made a distinction there. I recognize his experience in this area, but nonetheless, he definitely has bias. And the district court did, in fact, make some fact findings about his testimony and saying it was not specific or explicit enough to support their arguments. Unless you have any other questions, which you might.
Well, I'm just curious, and you may want to say something about means plus function, but if we were to disagree with you on indefiniteness, but agree with you on the means plus function term, where would that leave this case? What would you have us do in that circumstance?
Sure. So if you did that, and of course, the answer is that claims 1 and 2 only would survive. But of course, we think that that this term is indefinite. You don't need to get to fact findings to support that. You can look at the district court's claim construction and then review his fact findings for clear error under Teva.
I suppose if we did disagree with the district court's analysis on indefiniteness, but did agree on the means plus function limitation, we could expressly order or identify for the district court there's still a live indefiniteness question that he would need to resolve in the first instance. The theory that, well, we can't possibly know what an enlarged chamber, what the right capacity of that chamber is going to be, because it's now become dependent on all these different types of fluids and different levels of pressure.
You can certainly issue an order that would direct the district court specifically as to what fact finding might need to be required to be reviewed again, at this stage. But I don't think you need to get there. If you look at that testimony that I've referenced to you from Mr. Bai, I think you'll see that he did disclaim this position, such that there's really no way that you can reverse and that the district court could come to any other conclusion on that issue. Briefly, I'm just going to hit on the means plus function term. There's really two issues here, what the means for driving structure is and what needs to be located in the bottom section. And both of Grace's arguments rely on on its misinterpretation of bottom section as referring to the pressure vessel instead of as referring to the viscometer, which is what it refers to, as you can see in Claim 4. Regarding the means for driving structure, you're familiar with your case law here. The idea that a magnet holder could be driving the rotor to rotate alone without any other components is nonsensical, and I think it just demonstrates a misunderstanding of what the quid pro quo of claiming in a means plus function way.
Maybe that just means Claim 14 is indefinite by only citing to a couple little components of the overall means for driving the rotor as opposed to the whole magnet-based embodiment as the structure.
So that wouldn't be the case, and it doesn't need to be the case, because Claim 14 is just claiming the means for coupling way of driving the rotor, which the magnetic coupling, which in turn includes the magnet mount, a driving magnet, a coupling magnet, and a gearbox or motor. So Claim 14 fits well into, it is narrower than Claim 4, so it fits into that.
Just so I understand, for Claim 14, when it says magnet coupling, are you interpreting that term to be all the components that relate to a magnet-based means for driving the rotor?
Yes, exactly, and that is what the district court did.
Even though the spec, when it identifies a magnet coupling, it only identifies those two opposing magnets through the pressure wall?
Yes, because as the court found, you need the magnet mount, a driving magnet, a coupling magnet, and a gearbox or a motor, or else you can't drive. You can't drive this. And the second issue, I realize I'm over my time.
That's okay.
Okay. The second issue relates to where the located clause refers to the means for driving, and that does refer to the means for driving. And if you look at Claim 4, particularly Elements B and C, in Element B, we introduced the rotor, and we described the rotor. It would have been natural if the rotor was what had to be located at the bottom section to say it in Element B. In Element C, we describe the means for driving. And it's very grammatically awkward if the patentee intended rotor to be located in at least one bottom section for it to put it there.
Why would it be awkward to put it in there? I mean, obviously it could have been rewritten to say means for driving the rotor to rotate, wherein the rotor is located in the bottom section. I mean, that would have been fine and not awkward, right?
Yeah, the patentee could have clarified that in numerous ways if that's what he intended, but let me give you an example. If I said he threw a rose from his balcony to me, there's a little bit of ambiguity there. Did the rose come? Was he standing on his balcony when he threw the rose?
Can you repeat the sentence?
Sure, sorry.
He
threw a rose
from
his balcony to me. Mm-hmm. Is he standing on his balcony throwing the rose, or was the rose from the garden on his balcony? There's a little bit of ambiguity there, but that's not the situation we have here. We have, he threw a rose to me from his balcony. We've now moved the balcony away from the rose, making it clear that it's the throwing action. So
I'll have to re-listen to this portion of the argument. So.
Okay. Happy to repeat it.
But just go back to the concession that you say we will find, I think, at pages 782 and 800 of the appendix.
Yeah.
The plaintiff's expert, who I know is the plaintiff, basically, as well, his testimony. What is the concession that you see is being made there, and exactly where is it?
Yeah, so if we go to 782, he's telling us here in lines 5 through 9, he chose the 12% and used that number in his declaration because it came from Chandler. And then he goes on to explain that he grabbed this from Chandler's brochure, which is a misreading of Chandler's brochure. So then if we go on to appendix page 800, you'll see line 1, he was asked, in what situations will the physical properties of a test sample not affect its compressibility? Now, to prevail here, the answer has to be, it will never affect it. It's always going to compress the same way. A person of skill in the art would know that. But he said, I cannot answer your question. He couldn't provide an example.
Well, he says it's not a yes or no.
Yeah, he could not answer that question. Now, you'll notice in the record here from 784 to 800, there's a skip. There's relevant testimony in there that I'd be happy to provide the court in a 20HA. It wasn't included in the appendix because of the court's rules, and it wasn't cited directly in the brief. Frankly, we didn't expect them to challenge what seemed like a very normal physical characteristic that slurries with different materials would compress at different amounts at the same pressure. So I'm happy to submit that via 20HA for Your Honor's consideration.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's see. Okay, we'll give Mr. Laney 4 minutes.
Thank you so much.
If he needs it.
I will move as quickly as possible. Your Honor, the filled with the pressurization fluid that we talked about, the different apparatuses, that was briefed like crazy in the district court. They moved to invalidate our claim. We responded. The judge ruled our way. They never appealed it. They had to appeal it. They had to get that issue up here during this appeal for it to be in front of us. And now that they have it, that has been
what,
waived.
I'm sorry, what is it that they needed to appeal? They won.
No, the issue that Your Honor sort of brought up sua sponte about this device holding different fluids and how that related to the patent, that was briefed. They lost. They never appealed. That should be waived. My client is not.
That's not before us today. We're not going to be able to resolve that in this appeal.
But Your Honor, you mentioned that you could remand back and start us over on that point, and we would just say that'd be tremendously prejudicial to us. My client's not a $60 billion company, and we think they've waived that strongly.
But you don't want a remand?
No, of course I want a remand. I don't want a remand, I'm sorry, on this point about whether it's a combined.
Are you saying the only relief you really want is that we find your claims are not indefinite? If we say there's more to litigate on indefiniteness, you say don't bother?
No, Your Honor, I retract my comment. I guess we think if there's more to litigate on indefiniteness, we're happy to do it. We just think that that particular ground was not raised on appeal or challenged and that it's too late to revisit.
Can you just briefly comment on Ms. Goldenberg's observation that when you go through the written description and it talks about chambers 4549 and multiple embodiments talk about wanting chamber 49 to end up being at least half filled with test sample.
Yes, sir.
So is that something that, I mean, if we're going to run into your specification and start trying to draw out a definition, why wouldn't that be part of the definition?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm going to direct the court to column 10 down at the bottom, line 64 through 67. This is right after we finished talking about our preferred embodiment and the other two examples. It's in the very bottom right corner. Our patentee, and I'll take off my mask, I'm sorry. Our patentee says it is not necessary to have both chamber 45 and chamber 49. With just chamber 45 or chamber 49 and sufficient volume, pressurization fluid and testable can still be separated. So what he's saying here is in all the three embodiments I taught to this point, it was 45 plus 49, but you don't have to have both of them. You could just have one big one. So that addresses that first portion of your question, Your Honor. Second portion about leaving fluid in there, it's not about how much, and I'll go to the preferred embodiment, that's on column 6, Your Honor, at the top. It's not about how much you leave in there. It says chamber 45, 49 are large enough that at maximum rated pressure, chamber 49 is still at least half filled with sample fluid. What the baseline is, this ensures the accuracy of the measurement because measurement zone below anti-mixer bottom fin 82 is always totally filled with sample fluid. So that's all that matters. And if you go to the next paragraph, it provides even more detail. It says, because anti-mixer bottom fin 82 separates lower measurement zone and chamber 49, fluid inside of chamber 49 is relatively static. So what it's saying...
Before your time wraps up, can you just confirm one thing for me? Can you turn to appendix page 29?
Yes, ma'am, Your Honor.
Appreciate it.
You said 29?
Yes. 29. And as the opposing counsel indicated, you've had various constructions that you've been talking about. I just want to make sure the construction that you're looking at or proposing with respect to large chambers either captured here or you can at least point me to the page where it's the construction that you're really standing by at this point.
Yes, Your Honor, we want an enlarged chamber that, enlarged chamber is one that is big enough to fill the compression void and make sure no pressurization fluid can seep into that bottom
right,
chamber.
Right, but just Judge Cunningham is referring to a sentence right in the middle of A29, where it begins with the words, Grace argues.
Is that what you're...
I'm sorry, what page of the appendix?
29. Is that the construction you're arguing for? That's my question.
Yes, Your Honor, we would go for that construction. To finish your question real quick, briefly, Your Honor, and right after we talk about this column 6, we say the whole point of it, the whole point of this chamber is it must make sure below that bottom fin in the test area always totally filled with sample fluid. Says it again in the next paragraph. Says, additionally, separates lower measurement zone, chamber 49. Fluid inside of chamber 49 is relatively static. So it's saying when you have that interface of the oil and the test sample, it's going to be above that bottom fin. So there's no stirring up there.
Okay.
So
we
that
have to go.
Okay. I'm so sorry.
Case is submitted.